Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host and self-proclaimed flow artist, Mikala Ann. This week, we are welcoming guest Amaya Rourke, astrologer, ritualist, artist, teacher, and writer residing in the northwest of the Republic of Ireland. Amaya's work is guided by her animistic, land-based, spiritual, and magical practice, helping her to return to and reveal the wild and creative terrestrial origins of astrology and mythopoetics. In this episode, Amaya shares with us her theories on creativity and praxis in regards to her aspirations in guiding clients towards the cultivation of a deeply nourishing and co-creative relationship with the quiet rumbling of deep enchantment and living art of the more than human world. In what ways is our art our children? What does it mean to be dead while alive? How might we fully embody the nature of our own authentic vulnerabilities? What can go wrong when our art, as our children, begin to be perceived by others as a commodifiable object? What does it look like to speak to someone soul to soul? And how might we cultivate thresholds of safety for ourselves as well as others? What does it mean to be in a state of flow? All this and more in today's episode of Saturn Vox. To find out more on Saturn Vox, check out their Instagram and Twitter at Saturn Vox, or visit their website www.saturnvox.com. If you want to support the show towards goals of better equipment, merch, and bonus material, please check out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/SaturnVox, where one can join in on our book club and Discord communities.
So much, Mikala. I am in transition, is how I would put it. So it's not a clean and easy description of myself, but I think that's actually more honest for most people. What have I done or what do I do? I am an animist folk witch who is an astrologer, and I specialize in fixed stars and shifting my practice more and more towards what I would call observable astrology rather than theoretical astrology, with an emphasis especially on creativity and ritual as it actually is an act of creativity. This has become more of a focus for me because I feel that we have separated a lot of our everyday lives from more of a living praxis. Now, full disclosure, I have a third house stellium, so I'm kind of like praxis obsessed. And I think we're in a state at the moment where we need to move back into this place of craft, not just in the sense of what we'd consider like classical magic or the stuff that you find on like Instagram or TikTok, but in the sense of like your life being a living piece of art and being so deeply embedded in a sense of place and time through acts that are craft oriented that do become a ritual in and of themselves. And that's where my practice is currently shifting at the moment, culminating in the minute right now, preparing an online publication of my own writing. I have written in the past and I've been featured in a few books, but this is going to be something different because it's marrying more of that mundane with what I call the enchanted.
Oh, lovely. Oh, I'm so excited for you and for this. And I do appreciate the authenticity in the way that you have described your transition from point A to point B. I guess the first question I want to start with is, do you think you could break down in your own words the difference between theoretical astrology and this more like praxis-informed astrology? Like what is it like to work astrology with your hands instead of your mind?
Yeah. So this is not to dog on any type of astrology, because I think that every single type of astrology out there has a purpose and it serves various different people. It is a spiritual tool, and I think we should use the tools that are in front of us for whatever we need at the moment. I come from a background of, first, I was a modern astrologer, and I had a bit of an existential crisis one day while a client asked me if I could use whole sign houses, and I had no idea what they were talking about. So I actually completely like pulled my shingle down, stopped doing readings, and studied traditional astrology, or more like Hellenistic based astrology, for a while. And in that process, I had a moment where I was looking at my chart. I had started getting interested in the fixed stars, and I saw that I had a conjunction with this glorious star, Vega. I wanted to see it. And at the time, I was a nomad traveling through Europe with my partners. And I was in this gorgeous, like very remote part of the Czech Republic. And you could see the stars so clearly that like the Milky Way would just splay out in front of you, as if that's how the sky should always look. And that was a pretty remarkable moment. But one thing that happened is I went looking for Vega, which is supposed to be at 15 degrees Capricorn, and it wasn't there. It was actually on the other side of the sky altogether. And that also sent me into an existential spiral. And so I had to figure out why. And in that process for the last, I don't know, it's been several years, I've become more and more oriented to where the actual like sun and stars, specifically the stars and moon, if I'm being honest, are located in a given time, and observing them, truly observing them. Because when you get even further back before like Hellenistic astrology, in every indigenous culture around the world, the original astrology was stars and the moon. And we thought that the planets were also stars. And so before we figured out like, oh, there's these planets and they've got, you know, these different cycles, we really were making all these prognostications and connecting our like agricultural calendars and ritual calendars with these stars in the sky. And you see this especially with the Egyptians, because they created the first calendar that we've got documented, called the Decans. And the Decans are very different today than what they were previously. Previously, they documented the heliacal phases of the stars, and they believed that these stars were gods that walked amongst us, because the stars would touch the horizon, and that meant the god was literally with us, and that would inform everything in their lives. And this is ubiquitous around the world. It's just not always documented. I know that there's been a lot of effort here in Ireland, where I live, to try to figure out what that was for the Native Irish. And kind of going back in time and like doing archaeoastronomy to figure out where the stars would have been. And there's been a lot of connections between like standing stones and stars more often than there is with any planet, maybe with the exception of the sun and moon, right? And what I'm kind of looking at is, even our ideas of seasonality are in the middle of such a tumultuous shift because of what's going on ecologically in the world, that it's actually really vital for us to come back into that praxis where we are actually looking out at the sky and in relationship with the stars and the moon and the sun, and starting to write our own kind of prognostications and calendars, because seasons are not what they used to be. They're not fixed. They're moving, and they're moving rapidly all the time. I also think that this gets us closer to these very numinous, very broad, very far away spirits that have been influencing and inspiring us since the beginning of time. It's important for us to root back in, not just to our bodies, but also to our sense of place. And sense of place was not just about the land. It was the relationship between the sky and the land. And so the work I've been kind of preparing in the background for most of this year has centered around that and how our acts of creation, which are much more than just art, but include art, were always traditionally timed and in relationship with these various different stellar movements. And how we can come back to that now as a both a relational recentering, as well as an ability to cope through some of the changes, uncertainty, grief, as we live in the age of the Anthropocene.
Wow, I love this, especially just this idea of returning back to a state of being children, instead of saying we already know how the seasons work, we already know how the stars work, to return back to that state of wonder, curiosity, imagination, in which we have to physically observe what's going on in order to comment on it, instead of just saying, oh, well, I learned it in a book.
Yeah, and I don't want to, again, this is not to, it's not to critique people who are doing that, because, you know, there's a lot of incredible techniques that I myself still use with some clients for timing and understanding the themes of your life for the year and different challenges. But I also think that, especially as we move deeper into this age of Anthropocene, that our attempts to kind of predict and control things are going to fall apart more and more. We're going to have to actually be in sync and in relationship and actually present, not looking too far into the future, so that we can respond to what's in front of us. And that does require that we go beyond a theoretical line in the sky and trying to look so far ahead of time in our lives and be here now. And I think that's easier when you see how wonderful and enchanting the real world actually is. Like, this was the birth of all magic to begin with. It was the birth of these calendars, was the connecting of what we believed were images in the sky with what we saw happening here. And we've gotten really far away from that. We don't do it anymore. Instead, we depend on what other people have done before us. And so I really want myself, as well as the people who would like to join me, to get back into that practice, because it is going to make us a lot more agile and ready for what's coming.
Yeah, especially with, as you said, like the ecological changes that we are going through. The way that you're talking about this, it makes me feel like we're talking about the difference between, you know, getting on YouTube and watching a bunch of dance videos versus doing the dance yourself. And that in turn was making me think about the difference between ninth house and third house issues. You said you have a third house stellium, and that is the house of the goddess, where the moon finds her joy. And it's the, usually you don't see this keyword on a lot of the house, you know, cheat sheets you'll see, but there is this ritual aspect to the third house, this praxis aspect to the third house. And I love that you're kind of playing with that access line of ninth and third, where you're not getting rid of the theory entirely. You're just saying what the theory itself alone is maybe not good enough, especially in times of great change.
Exactly. I spoke on the astrology podcast about the third and the ninth house with Kira Taborn and Zach Powell. And it's funny, I do have my moon in the ninth, and then I've got my stellium in the third. But I come back to a saying from my childhood that was like, don't be so heavenly minded to not be any earthly good. And I think that we need ninth house moments. I actually call the ninth house the house of meaning as well as theory. We need to have those ninth house moments where we travel abroad or we go to college and our entire lives change in an instant because our worldview changes. But then we have to bring it back into the third. And I also call it the house of praxis, because this is where, like, traditionally, that's where monasteries originally were assigned in the chart. This is living spirituality. I think it's Jack Kornfield who says, after enlightenment, the laundry. Are you really so spiritual if you can't make every act a way of coming back into spirit, of connecting with what's around you, of connecting with your deities, right? I think that right now we're in an age where we're obsessed with the optics of how things look versus the authenticity of real praxis, which you have to do a lot of third house work to have more ninth house experiences. Otherwise, you're going to be wandering in the desert, kind of imitating and making cheap, false ideas of ninth house experiences that leave you feeling really unfulfilled and hollow. You only get there through the third house. That's why they're an axis. They oppose each other, but that's because they're supposed to meet in the middle.
Oh, love that. I also am wondering about this idea that one might create a false meaning if they do not have right praxis. In that, I know when you sent me notes, you were talking about, like, our drive to surround ourselves with beauty, but it raises the question of what is beauty? And in our society, that's very, you know, basically a corporatocracy, capitalism, I think we are told what beauty is. Like, somebody provides that information for us, and then we try to structure our life around that. And it takes this, like you said, committing to that third house, living my spirituality, finding my own authenticity, for you to step into what you authentically view as beautiful and not what society is telling you is beautiful.
Well, something that I talk with my clients about is Venus is not just about, like, what we consider the kind of shallow corporate ideas of beauty. It's also the planet that is really responsible for the values we have in life and why we find things beautiful. And when we don't know what our own values are, we kind of go through life acting as if we're No Face from Spirited Away, where we're just mindlessly consuming, because what we're really seeking is connection. But connection can only happen if you know your values and what's meaningful to you. And so you'll blindly buy every occult book out there, every tool that you see, all the cool candles. And I'm not against any of this. I think it's cool that we have all these amazing renaissances happening, especially for those of us who don't want to be within the structure of an organized religion. But I think that we have fallen into the trap of thinking that the tool is the god. Mm. And it's not. If you really want to make incredible magic, you can do it with dirt, but it starts with relationship with the earth. And that means you have to actually sit and be quiet and not put it on your Instagram. And it's not always cute. It's not always cuddly. It's not always something that's pleasant, but it will help you grow and you will find it deeply meaningful. And I say that because I have an entire collection of dirt. And thank God all my normie friends are like, what's that? And I'm a gardener. So I'm like, oh, those are soil samples. But they're various different, you know, containers of dirt from various different graveyards and forests that I've visited here in Ireland and spent so much time with. And the reason why it becomes powerful magic very easily is because I've put so much into that relationship. And because of that, I also find it beautiful. Right now, none of the objects that we buy commercially have that much meaning. But that wasn't the case. That wasn't the case for most of our existence. I mean, you have to think about it. There's no practical reason to create things beautifully the way that we have since almost the beginning of our ability to make tools. But we loved it. We needed it. We wanted it. We were imitating the world around us, right?
Yeah, it's like we, you know, we were dancing with the erotic. I don't know. Everything that you're saying, it's making me think so much about the texts on erotic mysticism that I've been reading lately. All this idea that Eros, which is just to be present and to be on the inside of your spiritual experience, has been exiled, and we will then intake pseudo Eros. So like, I will consume as much beauty as I possibly can in order to fill the void that the exile of real Eros, you know, has left in my heart. But when you're talking about, I love this dirt, I love the relationship that I have built with the dirt, I love the idea of the plants that have decomposed down back into this dirt, or the location that I took it in, and that gives it meaning, that gives it beauty, is to me a reestablishing Eros into your life, as opposed to exiling it and filling that void with something similar, but not quite that spiritual thing.
Yes. It's so funny you bring up Eros, because I'm good friends with Jake Green, and he's doing incredible work with kind of understanding and breaking down how the various different Arabic lots in astrology ever came into existence. Like, how did we come up with these different formulas and the reasoning behind it, so we can then kind of modernize it? And we've been in a long, long discussion, because we did a workshop together on the Lot of Spirit and the Fixed Stars. And it was great watching how that would like deeply modify what normally the Lot of Spirit would represent. And now we've been talking about the Lot of Eros, and something we've been kind of throwing back and forth, trying to find kind of a modern definition, is we're really, when we look at Eros, it's following the command of spirit. It's part of its formulation, right? And spirit is really, it is what we want more of in our lives. He has a really great quote from Robert Zoller that's escaping me right now, but basically saying that, like, we worship something, all of us do. Are you aware of what you worship? And our lot of spirit tells us kind of like what that is, what we're pursuing. But the lot of Eros is how we pursue it. And we've been throwing around this idea that flow states, you know, the modern convention of when you lose time and sense of self and you're purely in the moment, that's what the lot of Eros really is. And each of us has a different way of getting there. And it does require a word that is a favorite right now of mine, fidelity, which means you show up even if you don't feel like it, which really speaks to the fact that I have a Saturn stellium. But I think it's necessary, because a lot of the best magic I've ever done, and I've done some pretty neat and big magic in my life, wasn't sexy. It wasn't palatable. It wasn't something I could put on the internet and share with people. In fact, oftentimes was instructed specifically from my spirit companions not to share it with anybody. And oftentimes didn't feel that big or ninth housey in the moment. And then as it unfolded through time, it was huge. It had rippling effects. I think we have completely lost the ability to really feel the quiet rumblings of deep enchantment. But the good news is we can absolutely cultivate that again. It doesn't have to be lost. And it starts with the cultivation of our own senses beyond what we can see on a screen and inside of these little boxes that we were never meant to live inside of. There's a reason why our health is just vastly taking a dive at this point. The human race is in trouble. But we can come back to our animal selves, which is probably the most magical part of who we are. And that's the easiest way instinctually to connect with the more than human and the spirit world. And usually that's done through some sort of creative act. And we have always been creating. regardless of whether we thought that there was a spirit or not. And there's, we don't know. Like the earliest art was the Lascaux caves, right? 20,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. We have no idea if they were worshiping those images on those caves or if they were just so in awe of the world around them, right?
But even that awe in and of itself is like being present in the moment. It is being inside your own experience enough to say, wow, the buffalo is so beautiful as it grazes on the plain.
Exactly. And so I think I'd written in our notes, like, I personally believe that art and ritual are one and the same. And it's just a spectrum as far as how we could say secular or mundane it is versus how modernly we'd call it spiritual. There was no separation not too long ago. It was all one, right? I think it comes down to like how intentional it is when we think about ritual, right?
Yes. I think there is like something that we lost through the Enlightenment period and colonization in which Western thought became dominant across the global landscape is that third house issues did take a step back for the exaltation of the ninth. And in that way, we removed ourselves from Eros even more deeply than we might have already been before that point, because it became to live in that sacred praxis almost became a silly thing. And it became something that society started to belittle or look down on or think was trivial. And you can even see that an extension of that today in that, you know, STEM is where they'll say you should study STEM. Don't get a history degree. Don't get an art degree. You won't make any money with that. But yet there's art everywhere we go, and artists uphold a lot of the media that we consume. So it's this weird juxtaposition in which actually you can look around you and notice that art is a relevant thing to study, but people will still verbally say, you need to get a computer programming degree. You need to study biology, not art history.
I would even argue this is why we're in the trouble we're in, because if you don't have any idea about the humanities, all this technology, policy, and newness is uninformed by the human spirit, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why we think, I think my favorite thing is to think about how there was this piece of land in California that had been just kind of ravaged by various different ecological tragedies. And the government was like, we can't use this. It'll take at least 100 years to like make it healthy again. And so they thought they were pulling a fast one. They sold this land for like pennies on the dollar to the indigenous people in the area. And within 10 years, they had regenerated the land. And that's because we've dismissed a lot of stuff that maybe doesn't have that linear, you know, A, B, C, D mechanistic, which means to find the one mechanic or the one mechanism that does everything. We dismiss anything that doesn't do that, which is funny because we really need systems thinking right now, which is lateral and creative.
Yep.
And I believe that people who really want an enchanted life, who really want a magical life, it's good to start with books if you want an idea of where things come from or just some simple practices to begin with. But you really need to think about this in lateral ways, in creative ways. We shouldn't be, I think that this is true for most of the occult arts, but art in general, we shouldn't just be wanting to imitate what came before. It's great to honor tradition, to keep it preserved so that we can always refer back to it because it's a wise elder waiting for us to come for advice. But it shouldn't be where we stop. And that's what's happening right now, is that we're either so modernized that we don't look at all to the past, or we are so obsessed with the ancient and the old that we don't try to do anything new. And this polarity and disrespect of one or the other is going to be our downfall. This polarity between what we think is logical thought and creative lateral thinking is going to be our downfall. We need both. It's not one or the other.
Yeah, it's like the Philosopher's Stone or the alchemist Solvay et Coagula. We need to pour both of them into a cauldron and stir it together to create something new.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of my favorite quotes from Timothy Morton, who wrote All Art is Ecological, is beauty gives you the fantastic, impossible access to the inaccessible, to the withdrawn, open qualities of things, their mysterious reality.
Ugh, it gives me chills. I love that.
And it makes me think about, like, what's really happening between both these polarities is we are trying to control something that is not controllable. I think this is why art scares a lot of people, and creativity is something people think they don't have, because it's easier to say I don't have it than to engage in it. Creativity is never a guaranteed path. Anyone who's ever danced, painted, drawn, baked a cake, done woodwork, your projects at some point take on a life of their own. And that is both thrilling and sometimes disappointing.
Yeah.
But that's because we think about all these creative acts as like self-expression. And I would argue that most creation is something that we're channeling out of us, and it's not really us. A little piece of us goes into it, but it's not fully ours. It becomes its own. And that's true of our magic too. I think that when I see how many people are kind of obsessed with like dominion-based magic, you know, dominating, commanding, I understand why, because you want a specific outcome. But as my magic practice has moved on through the years, been doing this for over a decade, I've become less and less specific and more relational, because when you have good relationships with the spirits you're working with, they're going to end up giving you outcomes so much better than you could have imagined. Really, they're beyond like human thought and human life. What we can imagine is so limited. We are there to co-create. We have our part and our responsibility in it. But at some point, we have to realize us trying to like grip everything is the symptom of the century. Trying to control what other people say or think, trying to control ecological outcomes, trying to control economic outcomes. I mean, that is essentially capitalism in a nutshell, is trying to control every aspect of your life.
Yep.
We have to get really, really comfortable with the liminal, because we are in a liminal time.
Yeah, and you're right that, you know, capitalism, the capitalist mindset certainly causes us to feel like we need to control our environment, dominate the land has been a large part of human consciousness since we settled, since agriculture. It's been about how do we shape the land to fit our needs, and it stopped being a co-creational relationship between us and the land as soon as we kind of settled down. And of course, that opened up the opportunity for our creativity to expand past basic awe and survival. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's all bad, but there does seem to be consequences that we are experiencing very palatably now, in that we have lost that ability to co-create We do, you know, you can even see that in the consciousness of where a lot of Western magic has reached, you know, with this idea of I am a god, I am the creator, like you will subjugate to my will. And I personally don't vibe with that. And maybe it is a Saturn thing as well, because Saturn is, I think, too humble to say that that he is the only god, you know.
I think it's definitely a Saturnian thing. But I also believe part of this drive to want to identify as some static thing is our inability to really come to terms with mortality. And the beautiful gift mortality is. I don't think a lot of people think of it that way, but, you know, from Saturn person to Saturn person, I have a memento mori practice. Yes. And it reminds me every day of how limited our time is here. And so we should be time rich. That's what I'm trying to cultivate in my own life at this point, is how can I be time rich rather than object rich? Because when I'm time rich, I can be in co-creation with everything around me. But when I'm time poor, I can't form relationships because I'm not available.
Oh, I love that. And it's such a good antidote for things like depression and anxiety, which are, you know, these feelings of focusing on either the past or the present and the malefic outcomes therein. Whereas if I was cultivating a practice of being time rich, I'm living in the moment, in the present, like you said, be here now, which gives me the opportunity to not examine things from the perspective of where I'm going or where I've been, but just living present now.
Exactly. And when we're in relationship and we cultivate this, honestly, all of us have an inner spark of creativity somewhere. It expresses in infinite ways when we actually give into it. And I think the key here is without an audience. I think most people, they don't want to start anything creative because inherent in that is in the beginning, it will be bad. You don't have skills. But that only happens. The skills only come if you're bad at first and you keep doing it. And the pressure to like show up and again, the optics of what will other people think and can I put this on display is keeping people from living their most fulfilled lives. Our most fulfilled lives are in the act of creation in some way or another. We're supposed to be co-creating. And I think it was Mary Oliver who said the most unhappy people she knew were the ones who never gave in to their creative urges.
I truly believe that, you know, when the Bible says, like, oh, God created us in his image, my interpretation of that is we are creators in the same way that we were created. And therefore, if we are not engaged in some form of creation or creativity, that is akin to basically being a zombie, being dead while you're alive, which unfortunately, I think a lot of people live that because, like you said, they are afraid to put themselves out there creatively, either because they think it's pointless or because they're afraid of being judged or they don't think they'll be good. But someone wise, I forget who it is, unfortunately, once told me that a practice implies having to practice, you know, which means you get better the more you do it.
Yeah. And I mean, what I'd written in our notes was accessing a mysterious reality requires that we're present and aware enough to see it at all. And that includes in the messy moments. I think a lot of people kind of want that lightning moment when they think of being in contact with divinity. But what if you started treating it like every moment was divinity? Mm-hmm. I always come back to this idea that, you know, we have so many ritual objects that we've uncovered archaeologically, but if you really look at them, they're not just in temples. They were in households, and they were not just put on altars. They were utilized. And you didn't have a lot of them, but what you had was precious because you probably knew the person who made it, or you made it yourself. And that presence is so necessary in a time where overconsumption is a driving force for why we're in the state that we're in. And this is not to blame every individual out there. You know, corporations are doing most of the bad shit, but we've also been kind of seduced into a zombie-like state of working until we are on the verge of collapse and then being unhappy and wanting to find meaning or happiness, we then consume. And it's a vicious cycle. But meaning and happiness comes from being active and participatory. It's not just buying that thing off of Amazon, right? And that's true also with our magic and our spiritual lives. It doesn't come from just reading that book or taking that class. Being active and participatory means going off the script because you're responding rather than following instructions.
Ah, yes, like how I did not write questions for this interview so as to allow it to unfold in the moment.
And what a beautiful conversation.
I know. Yeah, it's been wonderful. I do have a question, though, kind of harping back to something you brought up before, which is the there's something so real about this idea that it is the fear of how the other will receive my art, will receive my performance, stops people from putting themselves out there. And something that I myself have thought about a lot as an artist is, you know, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and how he said, well, the way that he was able to write Howl was he assumed nobody was going to read it. And that was how he was able to make something so vulnerable and so crude, but also deeply moving, because he didn't think anybody was going to read it. But of course, he did release it. He did end up performing it live and, you know, publishing it in print form. So I do believe that you cannot remove art from that shared experience. And like you said, it is a co-creation. It's not just about you, the artist. The audience also receives. The spirits also inform. As a person who has a lot of placements in my chart that make me feel more comfortable with spirits, I find it easy to co-create with nature, with my spirit court. But there's still that deep-seated anxiety produced by capitalism that creates a fear of the other. And I was wondering if you could comment on that at all.
I have a lot of thoughts on this. I think that when you first start creating something, it's an initiation. And that does require you to let go of all pretenses, expectations, or ideas of who you are going to be seen by, other than whoever you are co-creating with. But then you hit threshold, which is that turning point, and your creation becomes its own life. And I kind of think about creativity as every time we create something, it's a new child. And you can't keep your child locked in the basement. Some art truly is just for you and your spirit court. Absolutely. I don't think that every single thing you do magically, spiritually is for display. A lot of it is not. And then some is supposed to be received by community, but that's where we have a problem right now. Martin Shaw talks about how we are constantly in this modern age only going through the first two steps of initiation, which is initiation and threshold. But there is no return. And return would be like you've gone on your pilgrimage, you come back and you're greeted by your community, celebrated, given food, and now you can share the wisdom that you've attained. That's not something that most of us have anymore. You have to be very precise and intentional about cultivating a sense of community so that it's not just an audience. An audience is not a community.
And there's like a distinction between the 11th house and the third house there, huh?
Absolutely. And this is not to say that an audience is less valuable, but that it shouldn't, when we focus on that, only the audience, it will always kill our art stone cold dead. It's too terrifying. It's unrelated, especially when we're in a period of hyperconsumption where people don't see you as human. They just see the product that you've created. And so they don't understand the amount of vulnerability that went into creating it or the fact that this is your child. And so then they can make really nasty comments or they can treat it like it's theirs. And in some way, when you are an audience member, part of it is yours, but we've crossed a line in the last several years where we are mistaking the idea of freedom of speech with the idea that there's no consequences associated with that, because in a lot of ways on the internet, there's not. And as a creator, there is nothing that will make you stop wanting to create faster than feeling like you're being hyper-critiqued or that your art's being taken out of context or that no one cares about it or likes it. God, nothing is more infuriating and upsetting to me than when I put my heart and soul into writing like a really good thread for Twitter or something and like it gets nothing, but then I shitpost and everyone is on it. I'm like, damn, are you for real? This is where we're at?
Yeah, the only thing the internet cares about is selfies and memes.
And I think that's, I'd put in our notes this idea that we're in a mercurial age. This is actually something I listened to from Martin Shaw just recently, and it hit me in the gut so hard. Everyone thinks this is a mercurial age because we call it the age of information. But we forget that Hermes, or Mercury, was actually speaking soul to soul. And how do we recultivate that when people are disembodied and they dehumanize one another?
Oh, you know, that made me realize that if there are so many people living dead while alive in this state of being a zombie, I guess, the best way to communicate soul to soul is through psychopompic work. Mm-hmm. Even if they are not dead, you can still access that psychopompic network through some sort of mercurial action.
Exactly. And you know, information is not really that useful unless we embody it, which is a soul thing. And one of the things I've been asking myself this year is how do I move my practice into a space where I'm speaking soul to soul and not just teaching technique? We have plenty of technique. We need more soul. And a lot of times speaking soul to soul is not a direct thing, but we're not used to that right now. We want things to be really simple and palatable. But the reason why when you see a breathtaking sunset, it can make you cry is because it's not linear. In fact, it's not verbal. It speaks larger, and nature is not linear and clean and palatable. It is divine chaos. We should be looking to that earth around us, wherever you are, including in cities, for instruction on how to speak soul to soul and how to be present in a soulful way. And finding ways to do that when most of your practice hinges professionally on being on the internet is quite a conundrum at this point. Because soulful communication, it requires the other soul to be open to it. How do I move an audience in that direction, right?
And what what techniques have you been developing that have kind of opened this door for you to? So I know you said you're in a transition, things are shifting. This is the direction that they seem to be shifting into, is how to teach this soulful connection. What does that look like for you and, you know, your clients, or even for the art that you produce?
Getting hands-on. So a lot of the best teaching in our world is not giving you step-by-step instructions. It is inspiring you. And not in a superficial way. Every day that I have anything at all, like, get popular, one of my partners teases me like, oh, you're an influencer. And it makes me want to scream. Like, I don't want to be that, because I don't want you to want to become me. I want you to feel inspired to pick it up and try it yourself. And so one of the things that I come back to over and over again that started in my Saturn return a few years ago, is that the most spiritual people who actually moved me and spoke soul to soul with me, it was not their job to do so. But what they did is they saw a little girl who was not in a great situation at home, struggling, and they gave her the attention and enthusiasm for anything that she did. And that's what allowed me to feel safe enough to try things, because I didn't really have that otherwise. And so when I'd write a poem and I'd show it to my English teacher, and that English teacher's like, you have to put this into a contest. You have to do this, you have to do that. And I was like, no, it's okay. Like, I'm good. And then they would turn around and put it in the contest for me to prove that it was worth something. And so in my own practice with my clients one-to-one, I want to create a safe container where they're celebrated and called into that initiation, and they can have at least one community member that they can return to when they have finally made it to that threshold. I always say, and I know that my peers are often infuriated with me for this, but I'm like, you know, I actually truly want updates from you. I want to know how you're doing. I'd love to see what you're creating. Show me what's going on. Just that curiosity and presence without any kind of pretense is huge. And I'm looking for ways to do this through bigger outlets. I want it to be something where you feel safe in a space with me so that you feel bold enough. You can find that creative spark. I want it to grab you. I want it to claim you so that you actually allow it to happen. You don't fight it. You don't stuff it back down like so many of us do. In fact, I just read this horrific study that shows that because of how schooling now works with standardized testing, after the age of 8, our creative aptitude drops by 52% because we're being taught to give the right answers, not to critically think.
Ugh. Oh, that gives me heebie-jeebies. Because it is that like childlike space of wonder that is necessary to experience this like awe of the divine and to dance with nature and with the other and with spirit in a way that is, as you said, chaotic, but still beautiful. And if you don't have that ability to come up with a creative solution, then you are now confined as if in a prison within the problems of our societal structure.
Exactly. I think it was Ursula Le Guin. She was asked, like, you know, she got critiqued a lot for like talking about politics and revolution and being anti-capitalist. And then they'd make fun of her about like, well, you write fantasy, so it doesn't even matter. And she clapped back at one point and said, fantasy is necessary because if we can't imagine something outside of where we are right now, we'll never create it. It's vital. I mean, I always think about thinking about like Eros and flow states. Albert Einstein, who we'd consider to be like this linear thinker, he pursued this subliminal state between sleep and waking, like an addict. Like there's so many photos of him like half asleep fishing. And he says this is how he came up with all of his theories. He needed to be in that state. And so he was constantly trying to find a way to push himself back into it. And it was not this hyper-capitalistic, productive-driven, I need to have a specific outcome. In fact, he never really had outcomes in mind. That's how he came up with the theory of relativity. Mm-hmm. And if someone that brilliant understood that the way that we function best is to go into an imaginal state where we are not constrained by consciousness and its many trappings of thinking about where we've come from, where we're going, who's there, who's watching, then why wouldn't we imitate that? We don't have to be like, you know, Mensa geniuses to do that. But I know for myself, you know, one of my art practices is this charcoal practice. And my tools are really simple. I use extremely thick watercolor paper, a piece of sandpaper, and a block of compressed charcoal. And I put on really loud rock music in my headphones. And I get really into it, like the door is shut, no one can see me so that I don't feel self-conscious about it. And I call it beating the shit out of paper because that's what I'm doing. And it's because I use the sandpaper as an eraser and I use the charcoal as the drawing tool. And I go back and forth with it, back and forth with it, back and forth with it. And it never starts off with an intention of making something specific or even that I'll make a piece of finished art, because oftentimes, you know, you may not make something finished today, but it contributes in the long run to your practice. But oftentimes, because I put myself in that state and I get so into it and it's so embodied and I can be nothing but right here, right now, I make an incredible piece of art. But it's a completely unconscious, unaware kind of process with no expectations and no ideas about whether an audience is going to see it or not. It's necessary. And then later, once I've given birth to it and I can look at it, if it feels right, I can now share it and push it out into the world. And I think that we need to be thinking about ways and building in ways in which we can imitate that state, whatever that looks like for you. And for everyone, it will be different. I have Jupiter ruling my fifth house of creativity. And most people be like, oh, so like religious music, but it's conjoined alkyl, so it's not religious music. It is definitely loud and guttural, which is the meaning of Gorgon. But that's what takes me out of this space of civilized kind of thinking and concern so that I can be present and in the moment and just respond to what it feels right in my body. What feels right with my spirit consorts. Most of my artwork is inspirited at this point. That's because I got out of my own way. And I'd written to one of my retainer clients not too long ago that intuition often masquerades as chaos so that we won't get in its way.
Oh my God, I love that so much. I loved what you said about creating the space, you know, giving them permission, just being a voice of support. In what way does astrology come into this?
So we can definitely see astrologically in someone's chart where they might have inhibitions. I look a lot at the stars for like what you need for your process. Stars are more visceral, in my opinion. And so obviously, if you've got something like Algol in the chart, or like my entire Perron's chart is battle stars, it is absolutely not docile.
We share that, actually.
Always in good company. You know, it's not docile. And that means that I have to get off my ass and I have to move. And it needs to be as messy and primal. I'd say the word primal is important for battle stars in particular. Battle stars, monster stars. You need to come back to the primal. And for me, I realized it was tactility. For others, it may be that they just need to be standing, moving around, dancing. Sometimes you need to do adjacent creative practices so that it opens you up to your main creative practice. For years, I did various types of music. And for a very short period of time, I was in a rock band and I was a screamer.
Oh, I love this.
I know, like you listen to me, I sound so like chill, but I need a lot of physical catharsis, and screaming, weirdly enough, really activates the nervous system in such a way that it helps you release a bunch of your stress hormones and helps you reach a state of relaxation, right?
Yes.
And so I use a lot of different methods that get me back into that primal space, that before there was this idea of civilized human, what was it instead? For a while, I was kind of like hellbent on trying to find materials here in Ireland that I could use, like different types of earth, but in my local area, that it does not work. I live in a bog, so it's mostly acidic soil that'll just eat away at your paper. But we can look at things like that in a chart, and we can start to play. And I think that's a big keyword here, is play. I may not have all of the answers, but I have ideas. And so what we do is we toss around a lot of ideas until we land on one that really sounds fun to you. And fun is different for everyone. You know, I think that most people would say, I don't want to learn how to do melodic screaming. Like, why is that fun? It's just loud. I found it incredibly cathartic. And I also think that, I mean, I was definitely one of the boys growing up. So I wanted to do everything they did. And all of my friends were metalheads. And so when they got into metal bands, I was like, well, I'll do that too. So, and it was kind of fun being the only girl I knew who could do it. So when I think about things like that for my clients and I look at their charts, I'm like, oh, you've got this star, that star. For some of them, if they've got like a lot of what I call, what is the word I use exactly? Vessel stars. Stars where you're more of a container that gets poured into. We talk about various different ways to turn off the conscious mind, to allow yourself to be that kind of channel for whatever needs to come through. Some of them are adventure stars. You might literally need to get out of your house and go do something that really thrills you. A lot of this is learning how to clear the blocks out of the way. And then I might say, what is the low stakes goal that we can commit to? Mind you, I'm very Saturnian, but I think that good Saturn is Saturn that realizes we need realistic commitments. And so I want to find something that feels as non-threatening as possible. So it could be, well, maybe I don't want to make a painting, but I do want to play with the colors because it makes me zen out. Okay, well, could you do that 3 times this week? Let's find out how we can do that. And what is the process that leads you to feeling inspired enough to even play with the colors? Leaves you feeling relaxed and safe enough? And we can look to the chart for various clues. And sometimes that does require remediation, because you might have like a killer Venus with just the eye for aesthetics, but it might be in some harsh aspects with the malefics, or it might be conjoined a star that's really counter to its nature. And we might need to balance things right back out so that you feel enabled. And at the same time, these various different ancestral parentages of your celestial nature are fulfilled in different ways so that they don't feel the need to express in the way they were previously, right? So if you have like a, again, using Venus as an example, detrimented Venus, it's conjoined like a very harsh star. I could say, well, what if you got into a martial art, which could be very Venusian and dance-like, to give expression to that star? And we also want to find an actual art form that would suit you best. But first, we need that martial art to give that star a very particular space so that it's not coming through in everything. I find with most challenging charts, it's a matter of not having a proper channel of expression. That's why it becomes problematic, right? So let's find that, a proper channel of expression, and then let's see what happens. Let's see what space opens up for you.
So what I'm hearing here is that allowing yourself to be in right relationship with your own, you know, authenticity and your own, you know, spirits that you have the most immediate access with through either, you know, aspects of, you know, between planets or conjunctions with different fixed stars or even in your parents, that is almost the key to becoming in right relation with community and with the human other. Is we start with ourself and our spiritual side, and then the rest just kind of unfolds from there.
Exactly. If we don't have good relationship with ourselves and those ancestral celestial influences in our lives, it's very hard, even if you have a great community, to ever feel safe. It starts with you. And what I find interesting is that when you start to reorient in that way and get into good relationship with these various different beings and counselors that are always waiting for your attention, a lot of things clear out of the way. And that includes the people who would otherwise get in the way of your creativity in a human sense. They suddenly don't have an interest in you. And it's because you're fully embodying who you are meant to be. And when we're there, I always say, like with Saturn returns, for example, we need to ask ourselves, who do I want to become? Because we have choice today that we've never had before. Who do I want to become? And if we focus on becoming that person, that means naturally we will take the right actions associated with that person. So I like to ask, like, you know, if you could be anyone, including fictional characters that you greatly admire, who would that be? And this is an exercise I did during my Saturn return because I pretty much lost my identity. I had attached my identity to a job that I realized I hated. So I left that job and then I was like, who am I? And the realization that I could be anyone was both wonderful and terrifying. It's a lot easier to just like get attached to like, you know, your job or something outside of yourself. And so kind of hacking away at that idea, I was like, okay, if I could be anyone, past, present, future, fictional or real, who would I want to be? And I always come back to like, who do I want to be remembered as or like? And it actually was John Keating from the Dead Poets Society, the teacher.
Favorite movie, one of them.
I know, basically anything Robin Williams is in. But, you know, it really was that because I had teachers like that growing up who did open up and free me to have that creative practice that probably saved me from, you know, killing myself prematurely. And I know how many people come to me as an astrologer and a spiritual counselor and their witch that feel that way right now in their lives. Everything feels meaningless and purposeless, and they're just running on a hamster wheel. And what's the point of all this? And I always come back to that quote from that movie. And it's like, you know, science and engineering is cool, but we live for poetry and beauty and love. And how can we create more of that in your life so that you can get off the hamster wheel? So if we come back to wanting to become who we want to become, because we have that choice. And of course, I'm not literally going to become John Keating. I become myself because there's a reason I resonated with that. Then we can take the actions from there. And what good is it to teach poetry and say, boys, you can make any poetry you want, but you don't make your own. So that requires that I actually have to do the thing that I encourage others to do.
And that's very Saturnian as well. Practice what you preach.
Yes. So when I'm sitting down with clients and they're like, I don't like who I am or I'm miserable, I ask them, well, who would you be instead? And why? A lot of times we'll have superficial answers at first. You know, it'd be really much easier, I'm sure, if I was a Kardashian. But when I really think about it, I'm a Scorpio rising. Would I really want my life on television all the time?
No.
Scripted or not, the answer is no. And do I want people to just be obsessed with what I'm dressed in? No. Or the fact that I made like new support wear or makeup that you can buy? No. Or that I went to Burning Man or the Fyre Festival? No.
Wait, so okay, when you say flow space, are you do fire spinning as well?
I don't. I am I'm eminently allergic to fire, I believe.
I just ask because that is a part of my background. So every time you kept saying flow state, well, I know exactly what you're talking about because I identified for very many years as a flow artist. Not anymore in the way that that word meant at the time. But of course, I do still try to live my life in flow.
I think all of us are chasing that because at one point when we were kids, while we were playing, we got into a flow state and it felt eminently incredible. There is actual science of flow now that has been researched for quite a long time. I'm going to completely butcher this name, but the first book written about it was Flow by, oh Lord, Csikszentmihalyi, I think, a Czech person.
Okay.
A scientist who was researching people who were high performers and how they could keep going back to it over and over again. I think that you'll agree with me here. Sometimes it feels like our best performance is a fluke. And there's just some people who can just show up and do it anytime, anywhere. And I became obsessed with that during my Saturn return because with the kind of loss of this identity, I didn't know what I was doing. And I really craved being in that space. And so what they found is like performers, and when I say performer, I don't just mean people who are on stage. I mean like they were studying extreme athletes, people who do crazy shit, right? How do they do that? And then another group of people, I can't remember their names, they then started researching that. And the opening of this book, which is called, I think, Becoming Superman, is about the group of base jumpers who did that opening scene in one of the most recent Batman movies where they have to base jump off of the building in Chicago, right? And that was real. That wasn't CGI. They actually shut down downtown Chicago to do this, but they only had one shot, which is crazy. Wow. I know, right? Like what?
Yes.
And so they went as a group to practice this on this huge mountain that was kind of infamous for killing base jumpers. And you learn in this opening scene, like if one of them moved a toe wrong, it could affect the stream of air for everyone behind them. And like cause them all to crash and die. And so how did they get into that space where they could do it over and over again and not crash and die? Because there was no safety net, right? And that's where you start to learn about flow, which is, again, this idea that you're losing all sense of time and space and even your sense of self, and you're completely in flow with what's around you. And they did do that shot in one take and it was done. Like no one died. All of them lived. It was fine, which is a kind of flow I cannot relate to. But I would guess anyone who's gone surfing, or I know that it's kind of similar as a former rock climber and whitewater rafter, like it can feel that way. We can imitate that in various different ways, but a lot of artists do it all the time.
Just one thing that I think is so interesting about this, that state that you're talking about, and how in a lot of ways you are able to accomplish what seems like, you know, superhuman feats when you get into that Zen state, and you can think about these old, you know, mystic folk tales about yoginis and, you know, dancing masters who were able to accomplish these insane superhuman feats. At one of the fire festivals that I attended back when that was a larger part of my life, we did a fire walk. And the way that we prepared for the fire walk was basically to just ecstatically scream and dance as a group around, like circumambulating in a circle, just to like raise the energy, get into that state of I'm both present in my body, but somehow also present in the liminal space at the same time. And then we were able to walk across the coals without it burning us. And I think that that in and of itself just speaks to how we have lost something of what we are truly capable of in the body, as well as what we can create, or how we interact with physics or the elements or nature in general, when we're in that state, flow state of both being earthly and heavenly at the same time, it really does unlock something in our potential.
Absolutely. And here's the thing, that is key and parcel. Being in your body is key and parcel to creating anything. One of the things that I work on with my clients is how do we get back into the body? And I'm not just talking about like get in a bath or eat a meal, although those are good things too. When you are staring at a screen all day, your nervous system is just totally messed up. And because of that, it does try to flee. Like your mind takes primacy and your body takes a back seat. And that's a reality for a lot of us in the work that we do today. And our work is like 75% of our lives. And so it's no wonder that we crave, what we really crave is flow, but we do it through, not do it, but imitate it through various means of escape and consumerism, whether that is sitting and marathoning an entire series on Netflix, or, you know, binge shopping or overeating. What we're really looking for is that state of what I call pure connection. Flow is a pure connection, which is why we have to get out of our own ways. What you were doing before you would walk on those coals, screaming, ecstatic dancing, and getting into this kind of altered mindset, it allowed you to be in flow because it slows things down. You don't have as much chatter. You're just there. We can do that at home. There's a lot of it. You can do that through breath work. You can do that through even if you don't want to scream, you can imitate screaming full bodied and just exhale. Don't make noise. It has the same effect on your body. There's a lot of somatic exercises that you can do no matter what state of ableness you have or not. And I say that as someone with chronic illness and a degenerative like connective tissue disorder. There's a lot of ways we can make this happen for ourselves. But we also have to have fidelity to the process, because it may not happen the first or even the third or even the 10th time you do it, because we have a lot of deconditioning that has to happen in the process of that. It does make it easier to have someone you're doing it with, or at least in relation with, because then, A, you don't feel silly. It's a little easier to ecstatically scream and dance when a whole group of people is doing it than when you need to do it by yourself. Sometimes it just takes the encouragement of somebody else. Sometimes it really is like, I need to get with a group of people who are seeking this out too. And the question I would ask is like, are you doing it for you so you can come back to this state? or are you trying to do it to put it on social media? Because that's the temptation right now that I'm seeing in a lot of various different types of spiritual circles, is this sharing of intimate moments that those are not things to share. And it does take away from things because now you're aware you have an audience. This is vital. If you knew that a bunch of people were going to sit there and watch you and judge you while you were ecstatically screaming and dancing, you would probably be a little less prone to doing it, or you'd hold back. You wouldn't even be able to reach that flow state.
Yes.
A safe container is really vital here. And it does come back to, like, what'd you do when you were a kid? You ecstatically screamed and danced. You got crazy. You played in the mud. You tore off your clothes. So we can do that today, but we have to give ourselves permission and we have to turn off the camera. It's very vital that we do. And then we can suddenly feel that spark come back. Oh, I want to do this and I'm going to actually give it a try.
I love that. Like the spark of the divine allowing it to fill you and giving it permission to extend from inside of you outwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this has truly been a deeply moving and inspiring conversation, Amaya. I've really enjoyed it so much.
I have been such an honored guest here. Thank you for asking me. I was giddy.
Oh, yay. Oh, well, I was wanting to ask you for a while, and then, you know, one day it just the confidence flowed out of me.
Well, I'm glad you did. I really enjoy listening, and we have a lot of mutual friends, so it's wonderful to finally have a sit down and talk about deep stuff as Saturn people do.
Ugh, I agree. I do always like to end my episodes by giving the person I'm interviewing just free rein to say anything that they feel like has gone left unsaid, or if you want to reiterate anything or bring something new up, this is your opportunity to do that.
Let's think here. You know, in our notes here, Alan Moore is talking about this idea of magic.
Oh, he's one of my favorites.
Absolutely. He's talking about what magic is and how we've made it into entertainment when magic was always art. And art is meant to transform the world. And that's true. Every innovation throughout human history started with someone trying to create something because they were curious, because they thought, why not? Or because they were divinely inspired or divinely terrified or both. And I want to encourage everyone, like, we can transform the world. You know, it's not hopeless. We have to wake up and step into our calling beyond the books, beyond the classes, beyond Instagram or TikTok, beyond gaining clout or acceptance from an audience who will turn on you just as fast as they pretend to be your fans. Really, the world needs us to come back to a true state of initiation and marriage to the liminal cauldron of creative magic that we were born to partake in. And I hope that you'll take that invitation and wander through the wilderness to find that for yourself. I hope you find that spark of fidelity beyond just what is popular, and you come back to your soul. That's my hope for you.
So beautiful. I have goosebumps. I love the idea of magic as the means to living an authentic and present life, as opposed to magic as a way to assert dominance over those who oppress me, which I feel like has been the magic narrative for quite a while now. And the work that you're doing and the work that you're transitioning into offering is needed in this world, and it's needed in the occult space. And I'm deeply moved by the work that you are doing, and I would honestly can't wait to get my own creative reading from you someday in the future.
Thank you. I'm really touched, and I love the creative podcast that you're already creating right now.
Thank you.
Being a little mercury.
It's a praxis.
Yeah, we talked about that. It is a praxis for you.
Thank you, Amaya. That's so sweet of you to say.
Thank you for having me on. I am honored, and I hope that whoever needs to hear this does.
When you are engaged within your will and in right relation with your spirits, the people who are meant to find the work always will. And that would be like my contribution to your message. It is just, don't be afraid of nobody finding it. Approach the art as if it is just to come from your soul, to be shared soul to soul, and have faith in the spiritual practice and fidelity with these spirits in your court, that they will guide the audience to you and not the other way around.
Absolutely. Well said.
Thank you.